Welcome to Inspirational Tales. When my guests on this podcast experience the most challenging times of their lives, they use these hardships to learn, grow, and better themselves. And as a result, they are now thriving in life. Their stories are ones of resilience, strength, and overcoming adversity. So sit back and join me as we celebrate them turning their challenges into triumphs. My guest on this episode is Mark Thomas. Mark is a sergeant with the Victoria Police, where he has worked for over 25 years. In 2003, Mark attended a call out which changed his life. This incident began a decade-long decline in Mark's mental health before he was hospitalised and diagnosed with PTSD, anxiety and depression in 2013. Following his diagnosis and return to full-time work 2 years later, Mark founded the Code 9 Foundation to support first responders and their families who are impacted by PTSD. In this interview, Mark shares an honest account of his mental health journey, including the signs he missed at the time and why it is so important to reach out for help if you need it. He emphasises the importance of self-care and that there is always hope, even in the dark times. Mark is so down to earth with a positive attitude and a sense of humour, and I have so much respect for him for shining a light on this very important subject. Hi Mark, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. How are you?
Good, thanks Jess. Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
No worries. So today we're going to speak about your journey with Victoria Police, which you've been with for 25 years, and also your journey with post-traumatic stress disorder from your work and how you've gone and recovered from that, I guess, over the last 10 or so years. But before we get into that, I'd like to start off by asking you about your life before you became a police officer. So can you tell us what you were doing back then and who you were as a person?
I was a mechanic after I left school. I completed year 11. I wasn't doing year 12. I wasn't a great fan of school. So I went and became a mechanic, which was good. It was something that I always wanted to do. So it was good to tick that off. But I also wanted to become a police officer. So I thought I'll be a mechanic first. Cricket was my game when I was younger. I really enjoyed it. And I was lucky enough to head over to England for 6 or so months and have a season over there with a local league in Nottingham, which was an unbelievable experience. And then when I got back, the first job that I was doing back at work, a great big drop of oil dropped and right between my eyes, and that was the world telling me I've had enough of doing being a mechanic. So shortly thereafter, I went into the academy. Well, shortly thereafter, a couple of months later. So I'd had enough of that. But yeah, look, as a person, pretty happy-go-lucky. Not much really stressed me out at all. Just loved me cricket, loved me sport, socialising. Yeah, pretty normal, really.
A bit different to being a mechanic, being a police officer.
Yeah, very different.
Why did you want to be a police officer?
Help people. Always been a fairly empathetic type person. And I just saw being a police officer as someone that, you know, can help people when they need help. And one day, if I could say, you know, back then, you know, maybe through all the work that I do, I may be able to save someone's life one way or another. And that was very appealing.
So you get accepted into the academy, you do your training. What was that like for you? Is it what you expected it to be like?
It was. Yeah, it was a bit different in that the discipline in the academy, I didn't struggle with it. As such, it was a bit eye-opening because I'd lived a pretty sort of easy life, really. Like, not too many rules and regulations at home, and as long as Dad knew where we were when we were growing up. So going in there where you had to have your shoes shined and black socks, and I wore blue socks one day and got in trouble. And yeah, actually, another day I wore white socks because I didn't have any black left, so... And then I got in more trouble. I mean, when I say got in trouble, it's just, yeah, you can't do that. But it was good. We had a really good squad, really good sister squad. We had a lot of fun, learnt a lot. Some confronting stuff. We went and watched an autopsy when we were going through the coronial process, which I found intensely interesting apart from a couple of occasions during it, which don't really need to go into, but but yeah, look, going through the academy, it was good. It was only 5 months then, and it flew by really quickly. But it was easy compared to what happens when you get out. That's for sure.
So when you did get out, What was your experience like as a probationary? You're probationary?
Probationary.
I don't want to get this wrong. What was that like coming out of the academy and actually going into the real world?
Well, the first time you walk outside of a station with a loaded gun strapped to your hip, you think the whole world has just stopped and everyone is looking at you, which is not true, obviously. I mean, you're just another copper rolling around the streets, but it's confronting. It's like, okay, games, you know, the game is on here. So, and you've got, you know, certain expectations of you. Like, I remember someone asked me in the city what streets that. I didn't have a clue. The only time I'd come to Melbourne was to watch or play sport. And this person, you know, didn't take too kindly to it. He was of the opinion that we should know every street is. And I'm like going, okay, I don't know what to say here, mate. I've got nothing for you. I'm brand new to Melbourne. I'm sorry. Walked off in a half. And it didn't bother me, but I just thought, okay, well, there's the expectation. So not that I sat down with the Melways and memorised every street in greater Melbourne metropolitan area, but it was a good lesson to learn in that, you know, we are held to a higher account than general society with a lot of things.
Did you know that that was going to happen going into that? Or was that something that was came kind of out of the blue to you?
Yeah, really out of the blue. Yeah, I didn't think it'd be like that. I knew a lot of people don't like us for whatever reason. That's fine. I knew that. I knew if people like us, that's fine. That's great. But I didn't. Yeah, it just never kind of occurred to me that the expectations would be to such a level. So, like, I certainly was aware and, you know, happily accept that we are expected to uphold the law. That's our job. We are expected not to commit crimes because we're the police. I understand that. You know, they're easy ones. But, yeah, the expectation of some people that, that we know every street around, like, okay, no, that's what I said. Sorry, mate. What do you want from me?
So coming out, so for the first few years of your job, what sort of things did you experience and see as a police officer?
Well, you see the best of people, you see the worst of people and everything in between, really. One of the things that really drew me towards being a police officer as well as being able to help people was when I was a mechanic, I knew tomorrow I'm going to start work at 8 o'clock and I know I've got this, and this to do, and then it's going to be 4 o'clock and we're going to go home.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I really liked the thought of, and I did like it when I was in uniform, I know I'm starting at 7 o'clock. I cannot tell you what I'm going to be doing at 7:01 because I just don't know. And that's, you know, I suppose in one sense it's a bit detrimental to your health because you're on alert and you're ready to go, but that's just not being on alert and having that cortisol dumps in your body is just not healthy. So, you know, like what I say to a lot of the younger ones now is make sure you're deep breathing, wash the cortisol out of your body and don't be alert all the time because it's just not sustainable and you'll burn out. But then, you know, some of the experiences, you know, probably like the bad experiences, I guess we'll talk about, but I still think it's the single best day I've had working. And that's, I got a phone call, I was stationed at Collingwood at the time, and one of the youth resources officers from Transit Department had been on an exchange to Northern Territory. And he got onto the youth officer at Collingwood and said, look, I've got a bus full of 6 to 16-year-old Indigenous boys coming down. You know, we're going to show them about, do you want to get involved? Hell yeah, this would be awesome. So we take these kids to Victoria Park where Collingwood Footy Club were then positioned and we just let them loose in the oval, gave them a heap of footies and like the skill of these kids, I'm just sitting back, just completely blown away. Like they had never been to a city. So this is the first time they're in a city. Then we took him to the Fitzroy Gym, which is an Indigenous-run gym, and Dean Rioli, who was then from the Essendon Footy Club, he was just walking out. So I said, oh, Dean, can you do me a favour? Can you have a chat to your boys? So he got on and he had a good chat, and then we took him to the MCG that night. Now, bear in mind, these kids had never been to a city, as I was saying, and I can't remember who was playing. I think it was Collingwood and Richmond. There's like 70,000 or 80,000 people in this Colosseum.
And I remember
to them, it was just like you could just see them. And at one stage, one of the boys wanted to go to the toilet. So, all right, cool. So, I was just taking there. I had two kids on each side holding onto my arm. Then I was sort of trying to get an understanding. It would be frightening for them.
Yeah.
Like, they've never seen anything but bush. And all of a sudden, they're in the middle of 70,000 people, screaming people at the MCG. How confronting would that be? But overall, you know, like, that shift was just, I'm getting paid. Yes, I'm getting paid to do this. Is this actually a job? It's just a brilliant day, and it's one that I've always remembered, just seeing these Indigenous kids. And we went to another, sort of like a, not a play centre, but a shed in Elphington had basketball rings and that. Like, just the sheer skill, pure natural abilities at any ball sport, and I'm just sitting there going, this is amazing. I cannot believe I'm getting paid today. So you get everything in between, some really awesome times like that, and then obviously some really ordinary stuff.
It sounds good that it's not all bad.
No,
we don't often hear about that sort of thing.
Yeah, and that's a bit of a pity. And like, the only time you'll hear from us is, typically speaking, for the vast majority of time, something's bad happened, or you're getting a speeding ticket, or you're getting arrested for something. But, like, there is so much awesome good work going on that so many people don't see. Like, we got youth resource officers everywhere. We've got coppers going into schools, being invited in to have a chat. Like, I had a chat to my daughter's grade 5 class a few years back. And that's the things you don't hear of. Helping out kids, helping out people that need help. And, like, there's so many awesome stories that filter through every day, and they just don't get the airplay, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I very rarely actually watch the news anymore because it's all just bad. Mm. Everything's just bad news, and it's like, not everything's bad.
Yeah.
But there was a day in 2003 for you that did change your trajectory of your life and your police work as well. Can you... Unfortunately, I don't want to go from that high to the low, but sorry about that.
No, all good.
Can you take us through what happened on that day?
Yeah, so look, on the 8th of April 2003, I'd been in probably about 6.5 years, and I'd been to any number of, you know, tragically speaking, suicides of, you know, of various ways, how people take their own lives, you know, stabbing, shootings, assaults, you know, so high-end trauma scenes, fatal accidents. And I was always fine with it because, and especially with the deceased persons I'd go to, I always sort of, I didn't look at the deceased as the deceased. I looked at, this person has a brother or a sister, mother, father, son, daughter, whatever. And they're going to be grieving, and we need to do our job the best way possible because we don't want to extend any more the grieving period anymore. Like, if we don't do our job right and things get a little bit ordinary on our behalf, well, then that's just going to hurt the family. So, and it was always pretty good. But yeah, on this day, again, no need to go into details, but when I looked at the deceased for all of 0.33 of a second, which is a blink of an eye, apparently. So Google tells me, of course, everything Google says is correct. But there's a wall, and I looked around the wall, and as quick as you can look at something and turn away, that's how long. And I felt it in my chest, and I just said to my offsider, who I'm still really good mates with, Lamy, I said, I'm out of here. And I just left. And I knew something was different this day. And, like, I can't draw very good. But if I could, if I was like an artist, I can draw the entire inside of that one-bedroom flat and everything about the deceased. And I'd be able to draw it like a photo. And I was in that flat for anywhere between 6 to 8 seconds and looked at the deceased for 0.33 of a second. So
Wow. It's
fair to say it did have a reasonable impact on me. And I went outside, and whoever went in, so we got the call to go there, so someone had found the deceased. So whoever that person was also rang friends and family, so they started turning up at the flat. So I preferred to stay outside and give death messages rather than go back inside. Now, whenever anyone ever asks me, what's the worst thing you've ever done, it's give a death message. Like, they are just horrific to do. It's part of our job. We have to do it. Someone has to do it. it was another one of those things that I accepted that I'd have to do when I was going into the academy. But they don't get easier with each one you give. They're just horrible. But I'd sooner do that than go back inside. Now, you talk about, you know, the world's greatest red flag flying right in front of your face and paid no attention to it. So we finished the scene, went back to the office, did the paperwork we needed to do, and we got on with the shift. The smart thing to do would have been to ring our welfare unit, which we've got a welfare unit with psychs attached to it, and go, I went to a scene today, it's something about it I don't like. But I didn't, and hence I'm sitting here speaking to you about it.
Do you know, because you just said that you'd been to different sorts of traumatic incidences, you'd seen all sorts of things before this day. Do you know what it was about this particular scene that affected you so much?
Got no idea. And it's
so it could have been anything that you'd walked into that could just trigger it.
It could be, yeah. So I've got a couple of different thoughts, and I've spoken at this with length over, I don't know, probably 7 or 8 different psychs over the journey. My own treating psychologists and psychiatrists, as well as psychs that I just know through work. What's your thoughts? One thought is that my bucket, when we talk about a bucket, my bucket was pretty full, and that just put me over the edge.
Yep.
So for those people that are not familiar with the bucket terminology, for every sort of trauma scene or negative experience we have, we put a little bit of water in our bucket. And then when it gets too much, it spills out, the bucket breaks. Another one is that, and I kind of subscribe to this one, is that everyone walking on planet Earth has a particular thing that will trigger them. Some know it straight away, others don't. For me, it's this. It's this. And when I've thought about it, this particular action in the past, even before I was a copper, if I was watching a movie or something and it happened, I didn't like it. So to actually see it live, I think that's just me, you know, surmising, really. I don't know what it was about that day. I don't lose any sleep over not knowing. It's just, it is what it is. I don't think, well, I'm 99.99% sure I'll never get an answer as to what was it about that day. And that's fine. So be it.
When you're talking about the bucket and the different sorts of traumas that you have seen or you do see as a police officer or any, you know, first responder, in the police force, when you were going through the academy and going through training, even, I guess, as you're progressing up the ranks, is there any sort of training or anything to help you to learn how to deal with the things that you are going to see or that you will see so that you can help yourself along the way?
So back in 1996, when I went through the academy, I think we had one one-hour session with a psych to saying these are what's available. But that's, I mean, we're pretty reflective as society. And in 1996, mental health in the community wasn't, you know, hardly ever spoken about. And then even in 2003, like, we had a welfare unit. We had psychs available. The resources were there, but not a whole lot of training. But now we're a whole lot better. We've still got work to do, like every organisation in the world, apart from, you know, like Beyond Blue and the same, you know, Black Dog Institute and organisations like that. They've got their stuff pretty squared away because they are a mental health organisation. And this is not just first responders. This is, you know, any other business. Everyone's got to lift their game in mental health. But we're a lot better off. We've still got a welfare unit. We've still got a psychology unit. We've got a number of external providers. So if we don't want to go through Victoria Police Welfare, we can ring an external number and get hold of a psych that way. We've got our police association. We've got their own psychologists. And we've got training packages that come out. So we're a lot better off. And the recruits are getting a lot more exposure to what's available, having talks from people with lived experience, which to me is incredibly valuable. Is that, and this is no disrespect to the psych industry. I mean, they've, you know, put my life back together like I was Humpty Dumpty, but I was broken. And I know for the listeners, I do have a bit of fun with myself too. So
it's good. Well. It's good to hear.
I'm very serious about it, but I do have a bit of a laugh. But yeah, you know, to have a psychologist sitting there, if you don't do this, this can happen. This is, you know, clinically what PTSD is. This is clinically what depression, anxiety are. But when you've got an actual member standing in front of you and you say, I'm one of you, and this is what happened to me, it's a lot more powerful. So having the lived experience, some members tell their stories to recruits is just so invaluable. And
you're talking like this as if it's other people. This is what you do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I actually haven't done the recruits, so.
Oh, but okay.
I do plenty of stations and work units and things like that, so. But yeah, like there's a band of us. There's more and more people actually doing it, which is really cool. So, and in that regard, it shows that, oh, it's not just Mark. Mark's pretty much the only one, which is not true. But, you know, I've got all these different people in different areas around the state all willing to talk about how they didn't recognise the signs and symptoms, how they were uneducated, how they were naive, or how they felt stigmatised because of these reasons. And you know what? I try to say to people, going off on a tangent, of course, but you know, people feel stigmatised. It says more about the other people who are telling you just get over it or just think happy thoughts, things like that. It says more about them than it does about you.
Yeah.
So don't let that affect you.
So I think this might be a good time to actually talk about what PTSD is before we get into what happened with you and how you progressed after that day. So can you just tell listeners that aren't 100% sure what we're talking about what PTSD is?
So post-traumatic stress disorder, I hate the word disorder, but that's what it is in the DSM. But it's really, to me, it's an injury. It's a workplace injury. It happens a lot to first responders and a lot of military, but members of the public as well. It's not specifically just for us, but it's a whole range of things. So for me, and the way I describe it again, have a bit of a laugh at me, I buy one, get two free. So I bought the post-traumatic stress disorder, and generally when you got that, you're going to have also the coexisting depression and anxiety.
The friends that come along with it.
The friends that come along with it. The uninvited guests that crash the party. So you got the classical depression symptoms, the not wanting to do anything, the low mood, the withdrawal of friends. Then you got the anxiety symptoms where you're melting down in, you know, on trains and buses. Like I used to love getting on packed trains just to see how people react out of their comfort zone. But then I was the one out of the comfort zone. And like I've got a great, my first sign of anxiety is my body heats up. So I know my body knows before my brain knows. Mm-hmm. So then I can stop what I'm doing and calm myself down. But couldn't back then because I didn't know I was having anxiety attacks. And then you've got disassociation that comes with it. So disassociation, you're just numb. You're just a zombie, which is a horrible, horrible place to live. I remember, spoiler alert, the night before I was hospitalised, I was sitting in between my kids' beds and I had no feelings for them at all. My brain was telling me I'd take a bullet for them tomorrow. I've got no problem with that. But actual physical feelings, nothing. And that's just disassociation. Then you've got the hypervigilance where I think the record amount of times I checked every window and door lock was 9 times before I actually could go to sleep. So that's what my wife was away. So my wife's at home. I know everything's locked up. So I'm pretty settled. But yeah, when she goes away, and I still do it.
So you don't trust yourself?
I don't trust myself. And I've got to check it. All right. And then by about the 7th time, it's like, dude, enough. You've checked them. Did I check that door? I think I better go check it again. Because you think someone's going to come in, do things to you, you know, murder you, things like that. So there's this whole gambit of things that come with it. It's basically a hijacking of your nervous system. And you can't sleep because your brain's racing. You can't go out because you can't be in crowds. You can't concentrate. Like reading books for me now, even now after, you know, 10 years after and I'm still recovering, I really struggle to read a book because I get 2 pages in, I go, what did I just read? Because the memory is so bad and the concentration is so bad. So I do audio books and, you know, I can skip around and listen to podcasts and things like that. So that's basically it. And then, you know, with all of that comes, you know, poor decision making. you know, particularly with diet, it's just easier. I can't be bothered cooking, so I'll go load up on, you know, a couple of Big Macs and large fries, which just accelerates everything, because gut health is so incredibly important, and the links between gut health and mental health are well established. So if you've got poor gut health, which is achieved through a poor diet, your mental health's going to get worse, then you feel worse, then you might have a drink. Although I've had a drink of alcohol for a decade, but so many people go, you know what, I'm just going to have a couple of beers, and they feel better, and that turns into three, into four, into five, and all of a sudden they're starting to get addicted to alcohol. So it's a very, very nasty cycle to get into, and yeah, it's not fun. That's for sure.
I think one that is quite commonly known about is flashbacks and things like that. Did you get that sort of thing? Does that have to be there in order to have a diagnosis?
It doesn't have to be there. For flashbacks, for me, weren't the biggest. I was having flashbacks, but nightmares weren't the biggest issue. There's two, probably the main ones I left out. So I will flashback constantly. Whenever I speak about it, I flashback. But because I took the power back from that scene through treatment. So that scene and that what I saw had enormous power over me, but through treatment, I took the power back. So I can talk about it, no worries. But nightmares weren't an overly big one for me. I've got mates that, you know, they haven't slept for long periods of time for years and years, because it's just constantly every night they're having nightmares. And I still have the odd one, but usually my brain just makes up really strange, whacked out dreams, but are not got any trauma in it. So, but yeah, don't need the diagnosis, as far as I know.
So how common is this? Do you know how common it is? Like in, say, in the police force?
Don't know the exact numbers. There's more and more being diagnosed now, but I put that down to a large amount of the destigmatisation of mental health, the more awareness of it, the more willing people are to go to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist, which is ultimately a fantastic thing. You know, I look at our veterans, you know, that are in the job, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, they wouldn't have had any of this. And certainly in those times, you just could not come out and say, look, I'm struggling mentally. You just couldn't do it.
Yep.
Versus you'd be ostracised. And especially as being male, you know, in a very male-dominated industry that has very dominated by alpha males. So you're going to put your hand up and say you're struggling mentally.
Yeah.
You just want to do it. So as we get rid of that type of attitude, which is fantastic, more and more people are putting their hands up to be treated and be diagnosed and get that treatment and get their lives back. So, but I also think, and this has been said a number of times through a lot of forums, I don't think you can do what we do and what the military do, and this is all first responder agencies, without being injured a little bit. Because we do see so much of it, and what we do, it's going to have an effect on everyone. It's just whether you recognise that and being able to sort of not push it away, but deal with it and move on. Put it in the sent folder, so to speak, rather than in the drafts. It's just no good doing that, which is what I did.
Yeah, like I think as someone that is completely, like I was saying to you earlier, pretty naive about, I guess, what you guys and girls see and deal with on a daily basis. Like I said to you, I was reading a few books about, written by people who were police officers who then went on to get PTSD, and reading some of the things that they went through and they experienced on the job, I was shocked. And I was like, I can't believe anyone could come out of this unscathed. Like, because if I'd gone to one of these scenes, I can't imagine what I would have done, or like what the, you know, anyone in the public would have done. And you have to walk in there as a police officer, as an authority figure, and not fall apart, and completely take my hat off to you for being able to do that, because I just don't think I'd be able to do it at all.
Look, we are different people. And like, I've got a lot of mates in the military, and there is not a chance I could do what they've done. No way could I have deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan. But then I look at people who work in a whole lot of different industries. No way I could do it. That's not for me. So it's, we're different people. It's, you know, people do it for different reasons, I suppose, but the vast majority that I've spoken to and sort of learnt from is just, yeah, it's just that need and want to help people. And, you know, we can remain healthy. You can get through a 40-year career and be perfectly healthy at the end if you look after yourself, which I didn't. And then, you know, like we spoke about earlier, our identities, and don't let your identity become your job. Yes, go to work, work hard. I do it every day. I love it. I've got the greatest job in Victoria Police, I reckon. But you know what? When I leave work behind, and then I'm back to being Mark, pretty much nearly a civilian. I go back and play for the kids or go to cricket or whatever. And that's a huge part of what we're trying to achieve now, especially through the foundation, is to get away from this idea that you are becoming your identity's changing around from being a person to being a copper.
So from 2003, when that incident happened that you went to 2013, when you were diagnosed with PTSD and depression and anxiety, that 10 years or so in between, what was that like for you?
Not good. It got progressively worse over time. So I was showing symptoms pretty much straight away. And then in 2004, I got my first detective position, and we go to what's called detective training school. And part of that is back to the coroner's court, because we're going through the coronial investigation process and watch another autopsy. The first autopsy I watched going through the academy, I was at the front going, this is way cool, apart from a couple of bits, as I was saying. But going through DDS 12 months after, I sat there and looked at my shoes for 40-odd minutes. There's no way I was looking at that deceased person. Not a chance. Again, massive red flag, and I missed it. And as time went on, and looking back, I see, you know, playing cricket, I thought at any moment I'm going to be dropped here. I'm not good enough to be playing this standard anymore. I'm no good. And that negative self-talk really starts to kick in, which is the erosion of my self-worth. And then you think, you know, have kids, and then you think you're a crap dad, you're a crap husband, you're a crap friend. And it just, you know, scaling upwards, getting worse and worse as each sort of, not day, but you know, each period of time progresses, you just, that removal of your self-worth is, especially over time, is just horrible. Horrible is not the right word. It's worse than horrible. It's an experience not much like anything else. When you don't like yourself, when you can't look at yourself in the mirror, when you think everything you do is not good enough, people don't want to be around you because you're just useless, basically. And then you start to notice that, so like in 2010, I was promoted to sergeant, went back in the city, and every time a trauma job come over the air, and there's certain jobs that sergeants don't have to go to, but there's certain jobs we have to go to, so deceased person, we've got to go there and supervise. So a deceased person would come over the air for a, you know, dispatching one of our units, my body would heat up and I was getting really uncomfortable. I had no idea what was going on. I now know that was me having an anxiety attack. And it just continues to climb until you get to a point, which was the 10th of February 2013, where I just, no resilience left, no self-worth left, and basically just broke. My first treater said I had a catastrophic loss of self, which sounds pretty big, but essentially it's just I broke. My brain had enough, and it's time to reboot, basically. Version 2.0 coming up.
So for those 10 or so years, you were still going to trauma cases?
Yep.
Essentially?
Yep.
How are you coping with that at the scene?
I bluffed my way through. And not knowingly doing it. Like it was, we had one where a person passed away in a hotel room. Fortunately for me, I had two really good senior constables on that day. And I just sat outside the room. And they were coming out and said, have you done this, 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 and this? Yeah, cool. But I kind of sort of thought, and this wasn't a deliberate action, this was just me bluffing myself. I thought this is, yeah, I don't want to flippantly say training exercise because we're dealing with the tragic loss of a person here. But I thought, I'm going to let these boys walk. I'm going to let them take control of the scene, you know, make them better coppers, and therefore they'll have better response to other community members. We're all better off here. And then another one where a person drowned in the Yarra River. And again, I sat off the scene. Like, I didn't have to go up really close, but I deliberately stayed a distance away and put stuff in between me and what was going on. And they weren't deliberate actions. And I kind of look back now and I go, geez, poker face. It was a complete bluff. It was like I had nearly two brains, whereas a brain that I don't know I'm not controlling is protecting me from seeing and doing certain things. Like, it's, yeah, I've never actually been asked that question, so it's a great question.
Really? I'm surprised, because it's like one of the first things that came to your mind. How do you keep working and seeing these sorts of scenes when you're going through that?
Yeah, just a pure bluff, basically. And I'd take certain steps, like I was at a work unit where I had to watch some videos that weren't really good to watch, so I'd minimise the video player to the top right-hand side of the screen, but I'd look at the bottom left corner and just out of my peripheral vision, I could see what was going on, so I didn't have to look directly at it. As a strategy, brilliant strategy, but brilliant for people who are healthy, and like good for me at the time, but again, it was a bluff and not having to look directly at trauma. So yeah, just pure bluff got me way through.
Did you at any stage during this time think that there may have been something wrong?
No.
Not at all.
That is the most bizarre thing. And again, I don't lose any sleep over it, because there's no point, because I haven't got a time machine. But like, don't get me wrong, I'm not the world's best copper. I'm not the world's worst. But I'm sat somewhere in between there. But I always prided myself at, like, going to search warrants, like the places where I found drugs and exhibits and things like that, like really well hidden, disguised, whatever. But I'd always be able to sort of sniff that kind of thing out. Not sniff literally with drugs, of course. But
we know what you mean.
Yeah. But it was, I still sit here and just shake my head and go, dude, how did you miss what was going on here? And like, my wife did say to me multiple times to go see a psych about my sleep patterns because they were horrible. And I said, I'm a shift worker. Shift workers don't have sleep patterns. So I just keep wiping it off as I'm a shift worker. Even when I was solidly working for a couple of years, pretty much 8 to 4, I'm a shift worker. Again, just like I never felt stigmatized. I never felt weak or anything like that. It's just I did not see it. And I don't know why I didn't see it. It was like 22, I counted them up one day, it was like 22 different things, signs and symptoms, and I missed them all.
Wow.
Which is bizarre.
Do you think it's because as things happen, if they were happening, I guess, slowly and increasing slowly over time, your body and your brain are adapting to what's happening, and then you're thinking then that that's normal for you?
Quite possibly, so, yeah.
Do you think that you were then far away from what you were before that, but to you that was normal?
Quite possible, because nothing was ever bang, it happened. It was like, yeah, that slow, gradual, like if you sat there and watched the tide come in, you can't actually see it coming in, you just, because it's so slow.
Yeah.
I reckon you're on the money there.
So that event where you said you had the catastrophic loss of self, can you take us through that and then how that led you to starting to get help?
So I worked the cricket. Step back a few days. On the 6th, I think it was, of February 2013, I went to ironically, a wellbeing day between my command and another command. And I was sitting in the front row and looking up and at the PowerPoint, and Joe was up there, one of our head psychs, and he had this slide on PTSD, depression, anxiety and suicide. And I still distinctly, this is one of those flashbacks, it's a good flashback, he said, don't worry if you're ticking a box or two. Everyone generally does. And I'm looking at the board, I'm going, huh, what happens if you're ticking every box? And then I developed, pretty much straight away, developed this really horrible feeling in my chest. The only way I can describe it is like the devil's butterflies. And I knew, that was a realization, I knew I'm in a world of trouble here. So I actually left there, rang welfare, booked in to see a psych the following Monday at 3 o'clock. So I thought, that's cool. My idea at this stage was, I'll go to the psych on Monday, get a couple of things, get a couple of screws tightened, and I'll be right. I reckon I've had 200 sessions since, and I'm still going. Maintenance now, but... and then Wednesday, that was Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and I'm just plummeting now. Like, I thought I was feeling bad on the Wednesday. As each day progressed, I just felt worse and worse and worse, and this is where you start to get into that really high-end mental pain, which, you know, is really indescribable. I have real problem with describing how powerful the mental pain can be, and this is... said a few weeks back, like, people don't suicide to kill themselves. They do it to escape the pain. And it's kind of a bit contradictory because they are killing themselves, but it's that pain they're escaping. And then I worked at cricket, voluntary duties, worked at cricket on Sunday, so I'm getting paid to watch my favourite game. And I just hated it. Hated the world, hated me. This is me. I thought bottoming out, it's fine. I see the psych tomorrow, I'm going to be fine. I got home about 11:45 or so, just took 10 minutes, change, brush the teeth, have a drink, went to bed, and within a couple of minutes, I basically broke. But I say that my normal human brain shut down, but my policing brain kicked in and then made a really good decision in, got my phone, gave it to my wife and said, ring welfare, something's not right here. And then welfare rang, put me onto the psych. The psych asked me, what are we going to do with you? In a nice way, sort of putting it on me to get a judgment. I said, well, look, if I'm working and I come here and speak to me, I'm going to hospital. Okay, cool. So she teed up. She rang a boss who's on night shift from Sunshine. He came and collected me and dropped me off at Footscray Hospital. So I just thought it was the safest place. It was somewhere... like, I was certainly having suicidal thoughts. There was no... so, like, with suicide, there's the three, sort of the thought, the planning, the action. So, fortunately for me, I was only ever thoughts. I never went to action or planning. And that's... I'm not being disrespectful of any kind of people who have, but just in my personal case, I never progressed past a thought. So, I thought hospital's the best place for me to be. So... dropped me off at hospital for a couple of nights in Footscray and then went down to Geelong Clinic, which is a private clinic, for about a week and a half. And that was when I got there, that's when I was formally diagnosed with PTSD, depression, anxiety. I'm like, kind of makes a lot of sense now. And then, like, as he explained to me there by my first treater, we're not going to fix you here. You're just here to let the dust settle. Your real treatment will start once you're here. So it was... an event, that's for sure.
So what was that experience like for you? Going from thinking that maybe there's not really much wrong to then thinking, oh, hang on, maybe I need to get a bit of help, to then being in the hospital, all within a very short period of time.
Yeah, it was, I wasn't really thinking because my brain had just shut down. The best way to put it, the lights were on, no one's home. And I couldn't be around people and... I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't make any decisions at all. It was just, I look back and it is quite fascinating how I was at that stage. Because you're just not capable of doing anything because your brain's just shut down. Except it feels bad, very painful, very bad. I was more than happy to talk though. So I sat in my room in hospital most of the time. I just didn't want to speak to people. So I started playing kids' games on the iPad just to learn to concentrate. Because I could see I can't concentrate. I can't read a paragraph. I can't read two lines. Okay, I'm just going to play these really simple kids' games to see if I can concentrate on that. So just breaking it right down. And then Cy come and got me for a session, and like they're not timed in hospital, which is good. And halfway through, she said, geez, you're strange, which is exactly what I wanted to hear when I was sitting in a psychiatric hospital. And she goes, well, let me qualify that. She goes, so many people come in and don't talk. She goes, I can't get you to shut up. She goes, which is a really good, healthy thing. Oh, cool. So, and that's since that day, and I've been able to talk about it. That's the easiest thing for me to do. I find it so incredibly easy to talk about my journey.
So once you come out of the hospital and you're now on your treatment and recovery journey to get to where you are today, again, nearly 10 years now since this has happened, how was that first, I guess, year or two for you once you came out of the hospital and you're really trying to get yourself back on track?
Learning, just so much learning. I did prolonged exposure therapy, which worked really, really well on me. So that's basically, for those that don't know, the best way to describe it is that if you hated horror movies and I forced you to watch a horror movie the first time, you're going to be, you know, cringing, you're going to be sort of trying not to look at it, trying not to hear it.
Petrified.
Yeah. But if I force you to watch it 20 times, because you've seen it so many times, you've heard everything, you know what happens and all that, it's just boring you now. And it has no effect on you because you've been exposed to it just again and again and again. So basically I went through my, sat there with the psych and went through that incident with my eyes open and then got through it. Yeah, I was getting a bit emotional and things like that, which I thought, okay, I thought I'd react worse than that. But then she said, close your eyes. And then everything just lit up. And it was like I was transported back to that scene again. So it was an interesting experience. You know, like the two main ones for post-traumatic stress are prolonged exposure therapy and EMDR, which is, I won't explain it, but it's like voodoo, you know, mind-blowing. So once that was done, it was a case of just learning to live again. So I had this, as I was saying before, I used to love getting on packed trains and trams, but all of a sudden I had this, the thought of getting on a train would put me into an anxiety attack.
Not even the thought of it?
Even the thought of it, really, like my body would heat up and I'd start sweating, even just thinking about it. So I was of the opinion that, you know what, I've got to get used to the world again. The world doesn't have to get used to me. So I went to a really quiet train line at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, knowing there's only going to be 3 or 4 people on the train. Had my phone, had music, had some Valium with me just in case I had a full-blown attack. The train would come along and I'm sweating and I'm starting to get emotional, but then I'd just hop on the train and I'd just concentrate on my breath and then just get out at the next stop and then just sit there and then go back. And that was it. That was the day. And then once you do it once, go back again, go a bit further. So just pushing the boundaries out in a somewhat controlled environment, but just push out a little bit. Same thing with crowds. Like I'm pretty good in crowds as long as I can move around a little bit. If it's a jam-packed place, I'm out. And that's just my life now. Like I won't be able to do packed in crowds probably ever again. So I can't do it. I melt down. And it's, you know, how much do you want to put into yourself, I suppose? And like I constantly remind myself of a time in hospital. It was the Friday night when it was the first time I'd heard about mindfulness. And I was having a bad night. We had a little bit of a lecture on mindfulness that day, and I felt myself going further down the rabbit hole, as I call it. And I thought, that's right. I said, have a shower, have a really hot shower or a pure cold shower and just let the water hit the back of your neck and just concentrate on the feeling and it'll help ground you. I'll give that a go. But then I worked out, of course, that psychiatric hospitals don't have hot water because then people can self-harm. So it was lukewarm water, and I'm a massive sook for cold water, so there's no chance I was doing that. So my first attempt at mindfulness was a blazing failure, but I ended up on the floor and I wasn't crying. I was past it. Like, it was that was the worst I'd ever felt, and the mental pain, just indescribable. I'm got the words, and I don't think the words exist. And it's when I speak to people who go, "Yeah, I know what you're talking about." Can't describe it. And it was then that I realized that realization why people suicide, because it's not sustainable. I was unmedicated at this stage, but it is just not sustainable to live in that amount of mental pain. And I constantly remind myself of that feeling, because it's obviously somewhere where I don't want to ever go anywhere near again. So, like, I haven't had a drop of alcohol since. I just thought, you know what, it's not something I need. I've got a reasonably healthy addictive personality, so I don't want to become addicted to alcohol. So let's just take that out of the equation. Cleaned up the diet. It's not like my diet's like an Olympian. I still have my fair share of chocolate and a burger and things like that. But for the vast majority, my diet is good. I ride the bike to work and home and exercise and, mindfulness and meditation. Should I do more meditation? Yeah, I should. But it's just that constant learning. Like one of my mates, Tristan, who I learned an incredible amount from, he had his own yoga business, was always a student. And I've just sort of looked at him, I've gone, that's what I am. I'm just forever a student. And that's why I love speaking to people about their own traumas and their own adversity. Okay, how'd you get out of it? What'd you do? What are you doing now? Have you tried this? Have you tried that? Oh, I haven't heard of that. What's that? Because I want to learn. I want more. Yeah, it's a bit of a cliche, the tools for your mental health toolbox. So, and it gets to a point now where, if I'm having a bad, I'll wake up. The first thing I do when I wake up is a self-check. And then if I feel all right, cool. It's going to be a good day. No worries. And sometimes I'll wake up and go, not going to be such a good day. All right, cool. Is what it is. I know how to get through that day. I know what I've got to do. I know I'm not going to be hugely productive, but I'll do certain things. I'll make sure I exercise. And then, you know what? And it's another one. It's just I'll be kind to myself today. I'm not going to be hard. I'm not going to be, if I don't get a whole lot of work done, so be it. Today's is about just getting through the day. And then there's some days where it hasn't happened for a while. But there are some days where I get up and I just go, you know what, today's a write-off. It's a bed day. And I'm just going to sit there and I'm going to stick on Netflix or I'm going to go back to sleep. And I'm not a subscriber to people saying, oh, that's just a wasted day. No, it isn't. That's just what I needed to do to get through that day. I'm not going to go and self-harm or try and take my life or anything. But it's just, it's a protection for me. Because if I do go out and someone does something, I could be liable to just go off my head because I'm just not feeling good. So, I'm just going to take the day today and I'm going to recover. I'm going to let my... When I do have those days, it's just a complete brain-free day. I don't do anything that requires mental energy, really. Just let it rest and let it chill.
And it's being aware of yourself as well and when you need that, which a lot of people don't have. And I think that's a really important skill to have too. And to acknowledge that when you do recognize that and actually act on it, I think is so important. Mm. But so many people in this day and age where everyone's rushing around, has too many things to do, don't consider that.
Yeah, it's important. It's self-care. And that's, again, rolling out all the cliches here, self-care is not selfish. It's fine. You're looking after yourself. There is nothing wrong with having, like, the way you summed it up there is so spot on. Like, everyone in so much of a rush to get everything done. This has to be done. You know what? It's okay to have a day where you just, today is me, pajamas, couch. That's it. That's all I'm doing. Let the brain rest.
So how long did it take you to be able to get back to work? Because you were still working with the police force. You're a sergeant in Victoria Police. I guess at the time you probably, did you think that you may even be able to go back to work? Like, how did that come about?
So when I was in hospital, I didn't think I would. I was telling myself, when I get back to work full time, I'm going to do this. which at that stage might was a support group for coppers. That was a bluff, because I didn't actually think I'd work ever again in any capacity. But I had about 7 weeks off all up, and then I started back at work. And again, this is primarily due to my boss, Mick, who's the king, unbelievably supportive. I went back to work on a Tuesday and a Thursday for 4 hours. And then after that 4 hours, I'd come home and I'd just go to sleep. You know, like I was from 11 to 3 o'clock, I'd work and I'd be home by sort of nearly 4 o'clock and I'd be asleep. It was just so difficult. And I was doing really, really simple work too. And then once my brain sort of got accustomed to doing that 4 hours, okay, yeah, I'm doing it pretty easy now. And then I went to a Monday, Wednesday and Friday for 4 hours. And when I was good with that, I went to Tuesday and Thursday for 5 hours, Monday, Wednesday, and just slowly increased it, but sort of changing days to make sure I had adequate rest in between. And then got to the point where full-time Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and had Wednesday off. And then just slowly started increasing work hours on a Wednesday until June 2015. Yeah, I got signed off by my treater to say, yeah, you're good to go, dude, 40 hours a week. So I took 2.5 years, which is, again, I'm going back to meet my boss. That's an incredible amount of patience and support. And I was basically left to my own devices with his support and, you know, the inspector's support as well. Just to, yeah, Mark's controlling his own recovery. He's increasing hours at certain times when he feels right to do it. No one's pushing him. He'll get back to work full time when he does. So 2.5 years. I'm and eternally grateful for that, because if, you know, if I had a boss who, you know, was pushy or nowhere near supportive, well, I'd be ill health retired by now. Easy. That's a no brainer. So I'm very lucky to be working.
And that's a great achievement on your behalf too.
Yeah.
So well done. And you've been working still for a few years now. So we're now 2022.
Yep.
How has that been for you being back with the police force?
It's good. It's good. I love my job. I've got a great job. Yeah, everyone loves being on holidays, but even when holidays come to an end, all right, cool. I get to go see the crew. We've got a really good office. Yeah, we've got a really good environment. Everyone's very open. People come up and they'll ask questions about mental health questions. You know, my whole, like I'm one unit within a bigger one. There's no stigma. Everyone's supportive. It's, you know, it really is a special place to be, and it makes going to work easy, which is great. Do I look forward to retirement? I'm not throwing my life away whatsoever. But, yeah, look, I'd love to be able to retire on my terms, not ill health retire. I mean, yeah. But if that happens, that happens. I've squared that away. I'm comfortable with it. If it happens, it happens. If my health begins to decline again, well, I'm certainly not going to go to the depths that I did last time. So, but yeah, being back and working full time is, it's something, the achievement is not something I recognise freely, but that's just my continual recovery to build my self-worth back up, because I still, there's certain things I know I do really well, but I still don't give myself the credit where probably I should be giving myself a fair bit of credit for things that I've accomplished. So, like, I'm a work in progress. I let the injury gain momentum for a decade. It's going to take a lot longer than a decade to fully recover from that with the damage that I did. So, but I'm getting there. I'm happy.
And you're aware of it.
And I'm aware of it. That's so, so critically important, is that the learning lesson out of it. Like, I've just learned so much. Like, about me, yes, but so much about mental health, so much about people, so much about the world, so much about so many things. Like, it's just, like, I've been asked a few times, if you could change it, would you? And it really conflicts me in a good way. On some aspects, no, I wouldn't change a thing, because I know I've positively affected so many people with education and speaking about it and awareness and breaking down stigmas. But on those days which it just sucks, when I'm having really bad days, yeah, I don't want to be doing this anymore. I'm sick of it. I've had enough bad days. Go away, please. But they just happen. So deal with it,
yeah,
and get through the day.
You're only human.
Correct. Correct.
But one thing you have been doing, or you have started a few years ago, is the Code 9 Foundation.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that? What is it? What do you do? Why did you start it?
Yeah, so this, the bluff for me when I went back full-time work, when I was saying before, the support group, I was pretty keen to do that because when I was sitting in hospital, I felt intensely alone. I'm thinking, no one could possibly know what I'm going through, which is obviously complete and utter rubbish. So I thought, once I'm out, I'm going to start a support group for coppers, because then if someone's newly diagnosed or struggling, then a bunch of us who have walked in their shoes can go get around them and say, hey, mate, know exactly what you're going through, so they don't feel alone. So that started when I went back to full-time work. I started it, and I just started a private Facebook group, really, and just tagged me Facebook mates and joined them. And I said, hey, this is what I'm doing. So they put their mates in as well. And then it expanded to professional fireys, and that's by no means any disrespect to our volunteer firefighters. They do an extraordinary job. Paramedics and our AAA operators, who we all agree have got the worst job, because at least we can see what's going on. They're just sitting on the end of headphones. I don't know how they do it. Much respect. And it just continued to sort of grow and grow and grow. And then a bloke who I, you know, very privileged to call a pretty good mate now, Rob, come along, and he had his assistant's dog, Jimmy. And we'd have group catch-ups. Didn't call them meetings, because meetings are too formal. It's just catching up with a bunch of people. And we'd meet for 3 hours on a Wednesday night in the city once a month, and then it was in Geelong and Bendigo and down the valley, and they were really good pre-COVID. COVID smashed us. But yeah, he brought Jimmy along, and the whole 3 hours we just smashed him with questions, because I was just fascinated with this assistance dog. And like at that stage, we had our pup, Tia. And when I was having a bad day, like Tia would just come up and just sort of nestle in and be really quiet and gentle. And Tia, unfortunately for Tia, she's a beautiful dog, but when Doggy God was giving her brain, she'll stand at the end of the line. She wasn't a smart dog in any way, shape or form. But she, I mean, she'd run around and go nuts. But when I was feeling bad, she would nestle in. And it's like, that's quite amazing. And then we're sitting around, Rob, myself and another mate, Ben, and just basically said, how about we register as a charity and we raise money for dogs? Because they're lifesavers. Jimmy has saved Rob's life. And I'm like, yeah, cool. Right, let's get this going. So you got three diagnosed nutters. Well,
Don't call yourself that.
Yeah, black humour. So we registered as a charity, and it's just continued to grow. So it's really cool now. So we've sponsored a few dogs, which is great. But we're also helping out first responders and their families. Like, we found out one retired policewoman had been eating 2-minute noodles for a week and a half or something, and like, we can't allow that to happen. So we paid for a few weeks worth of meals, decent meals to be delivered to her house so she could actually eat some decent food, and sending people away for respite weekends. So where do you want to go? Like, one of our mates is in hospital for about a month, is over COVID, so his wife wasn't allowed to visit. So when he got out, we sent him down to Queenscliff for a weekend, just him and his wife. We'll pick up the tab, go and have a good time, just chill out. A couple of weeks ago, we got, like, under circumstances, but we got some firewood delivered to a member's house because they were in need. So we haven't got this real strict criteria. Yes, we've delivered hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of meals, respite weekends, etc., garden maintenance, house maintenance. Like, people's anxieties are so high, they can't even go outside. So the lawns are getting overgrown and weeds are going everywhere. So a gardening company, go around, give the joint a tidy up, make it feel that little bit better, we'll pick the tab up. So we haven't got a strict criteria as to what we actually can do. It's just basically, how can we help? And we run a private, you know, online groups for members where they can, you know, and it's strictly positive. No political messaging. There's no anti-organisation comments or posts or anything like that. They'll be removed straight away. You're just there to seek support if you need it. You know, like, one really good example, a couple of years ago now, one of the girls posted that she was really struggling. She was safe. She's got a psych appointment tomorrow. I've just got to get through the night. And then I went to sleep. And then the next day I woke up, had a look, and there's like 200 messages to her. Or not messages, 200 replies.
Mm.
It was just like all these members piling in. Yep, I'm having a crap night as well. We'll get through this together. And then she had a really good psych session, and next night she posted again saying, thanks, I feel really cool. And that's one of those sort of occasions where you sit back and go, that's pretty cool. That's way cool.
Yeah.
We are, as I said, we are, you know, earlier on, we are different people, and we are one great big family, the first responder family. So it's just growing. It's just getting bigger, which is great.
Where do you see it going?
We've got a couple of things going in sort of one in the planning process, one in the advance. I can't really talk about it at the moment. It's a bit secret-y kind of stuff.
We'll hear about it soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, you'll hear about it, absolutely. You know, we've been honing in on the families for a few years. Really putting time, like we've got another online forum for private one for the partners, because the partners are really the forgotten people in all of this. Like a lot of time, energy, resources go into the injured member, but you know, you've got a partner, a carer, kids at home who for a lot of the time it's not fun living with someone who's struggling with post-traumatic stress. So you know, helping them out. We're working with Monash Uni to get a package created for the partners to help them cope, to help them understand not what clinically PTSD, depression, anxiety is, because clinical stuff to non-clinicians is blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. What does that mean kind of thing? But putting it in their terms so they will understand what's happened, how they're being treated in layman's terms. What you can do to look after yourself. Like we've referred a lot of partners to psychologists. Like, and we encourage it. Yes, absolutely. Go there because you need support because it's a rough ride. So, right, I won't say from the word go. So that started in 15. I reckon about 2017 we started really looking at the partners. So we want to do a lot more for them. And we'll have 3 or 4 different campaigns a year where we just want to, you know, get people moving, eating better, meditating, mindfulness, just those core things that will help protect your mental health so much better.
How on earth do you find time to do all of this?
Well, work's work, so that's that. But, like, the priorities are my own family.
Mm-hmm.
There's people who in the committee who do a power of work also. You know, everyone's got their own little job and, like, and no one gets paid. It's all, everyone's voluntary, so, which is great. And, you know, people just help out just a little bit here and a little bit there, which is great. And one thing's really good is that we're not trying to take over the world here. You know, there's no pressure. We're not in this to impress people. We're in this to help people. So, but there's not a whole lot of spare time, but it's fun. It's good. It's enjoyable. We're helping people.
Yeah, sounds fantastic. So how are you doing now?
I'm pretty good. So I wasn't medicated for a couple of years and then I plateaued. So then I got on some medication, but I was on that for 5 or 6 years. So last year I reduced and then stopped because I just wanted to see where do I need medication or
mm-hmm.
can I be med-free? I was med-free for about 6 months, started off good but just tailed down. And then in January, took a few days off from work because I wasn't any good. Got onto this new medication through my psych, who's awesome. And, yeah, I'm great. I still have days where I'm not much good every now and then. But, like, it's about 3 weeks ago now, I had a period of a couple of weeks where my sleep patterns just, for some reason, and I don't know why, and I never worked out why. No nightmares, no flashbacks, just couldn't get to sleep. And then I'd sleep for 20 minutes and then I'd wake up and, like, really wake up, and it'd take me hours to get back to sleep. And so be it. Like, I didn't get annoyed with it. My mood was still good, though, which is really good. Mm-hmm. I was just very, very tired. But, yeah, that's part and parcel. It's just accepting of who you are. Like, I will never, ever fully recover. It's a something that I will live with for every day for the rest of my life. And it's just accepting that. Not exactly happy with it, but you just got to accept who you are. And that's, I know I've got to do certain things. And if I don't do certain things, I know my mood will drop, my energies will drop, I'll get angry, or I'll just get pissed off with small things. So you've just got to eat well, drink plenty of water, exercise, be mindful. And that's giving me the best chance to walk around with a smile on the face, which is ultimately what I want and what everyone wants. So, I haven't got anything to complain about. I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky with the support structure. I've got my tribe around me is, I'm incredibly grateful to have the people I do in my tribe, because they make me a better person, and that's all I can ask for. And, there's people that will hold me accountable. If I don't do certain stuff, I'll get a whack from them, which is great. That's what I want. I'm pretty grateful for the existence I'm leading at the moment.
That's so great to hear. It really is, to see how far you've come, and also that, you know what, there is hope with this.
There is. It's not a life sentence. And that's, again, I've got to be careful when I sort of describe it like that, because I'm very aware that a lot of people haven't got the support structures around them that I have, or are fighting other addictions, whether it be alcohol or food or whatever it might be. I'm very aware of that, but the need for me to be positive, I don't need any negatives around me. I've removed people from my life that were not healthy for me. So there's some hard decisions you've got to make, but if you can make that with a support around you, hope is always there. Don't give up. Don't ever give up. As I said earlier on, when I described, I understand why people take their lives, because it's not sustainable. But another sort of saying, the most critically important decision you'll ever make in your life when you're least capable of making it. So just have those people. Don't be afraid to sing out. Don't be afraid to reach out to your GP or your psych or whoever. You've just got to talk. It's how you recover. Just talk and get treated. It's fine. Would you go to a physio if you tore your hamstring? Of course you would. You've got a muscle injury. Well, your brain's a muscle. So get it treated.
So I've got one final question for you that I ask everyone at the end of their interviews. If you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be? Why are you laughing?
It's a really interesting question, isn't it? What would I say to my younger self? I would say, learn to meditate and be mindful as early as you can. Because, I mentioned his name earlier, Tristan. There's two blokes, Tristan and Ross, who I have just immense, immense respect for. And they taught me so much around mindfulness and meditation and Qigong and things like that. For instance, in Tassie trekking, I had a really bad day with a bunch of crew. But again, my tribe, so they picked me up. 2 days later, I was sitting on a helipad at one of the huts on the overland trek. And that's only one of two occasions that I have been at complete peace with myself since 20 years ago. And it's because I sat there, I did some Qigong that Ross taught me, and then I sat there and I meditated and I was mindful as Tristan taught me. And there's only been two occasions where I can honestly say I've been at complete peace with myself. So 2 days after having a really bad day because of what they taught me, and a lot of learnings that I've had over the years in grounding myself, but primarily because of what they did, I was able to flip that completely around. So it's a bit of a different answer, and I'm not talking about sitting there in the lotus position, which is a very much a westernized, bastardized version of what yoga should look like. But it is so incredibly powerful. If you get a good teacher, one that's there to teach people and cares about their people like Tristan and Ross did, well then the power out of that, the power to calm yourself down, the power to relax. And with that, with the power to relax, it's a superpower. If you can do it effectively, it is, well, I think it's like a superpower. So that's what I'd say.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with me and everyone listening today. It's been absolutely wonderful to speak with you and hear everything that you've been through and what you're doing now. And I can't wait to see, you know, those secret projects you've got coming up.
I'll let you know. I'll give you an early heads up.
Love that. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. And what I say too, also, I mean, it's one thing for me to be okay with talking about, and I can stand on my roof and scream from the rooftops all I want, but when people like yourself give me a platform to project it out to other people, the positive story of hope and you can recover and it's not a death sentence and that, I'm really grateful for, you know, you and what you do, and, you know, I'm excited to hear your podcast progress into the future. Yeah, like as I said to you earlier on, your first episode to me was mind-blowing what you've been through, and, you know, I got just a massive amount of respect and great work, and I look forward to seeing you flourish in this area.
Thank you so much, and the same to you, of course. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Inspirational Tales. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love it if you could please share it with your family and friends so that we can inspire more people. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, please don't forget to leave us a rating or a review, and make sure that you have subscribed or followed the podcast on whichever platform that you are listening to it on so that you can stay up to date as new episodes are released. Thanks again, and I look forward to you joining me for the next episode of Inspirational Tales.